So, all right, so I'm going to be talking a little bit about my research on satellite tags and how I think they can be used to maybe describe some anomalies that we're seeing and spawn stock biomass, overall stock structure of spinal doctors. And Dr. Pierce kind of alluded to some of the other work that we've been doing on reproduction and done some work on genetics of the species as well, but not going to be able to talk about them during this, but time afterwards I can go into that. So, as all of you know, based on talks today, spine doctors, we know a little bit about them. We know they're segregated by sex. Males and females tend to move apart from one another. Ferocious and opportunistic species here. They eat a lot, highly herbivorous, but they do maintain a broad diet. And Dr. Pierce alluded to that as well. But what he didn't say is that including that is small children. And I will touch on that a little bit later on. And then again, this population is thought to make this long, sort of extended north-south migration at certain times of the year. So it's a contentious topic. You have commercial fishermen, recreational fishermen, one strangled species, right? So you have conservation groups who absolutely love it and are trying to protect it and serve it. To a certain extent where they love to sit on in your species list. And then you have NOAA, Fisheries Service, Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, who handles sort of tying this whole thing due to the Management Teams Act. So there's a lot of issues going on here. So what we have is scientists like myself who are interested in looking at this from sort of an outside perspective. One of the things that caught me by surprise and why I was sort of interested in this is some anomalies that we're seeing. You've got this falling stock biomass, 2005, and that's just a three-year moving average, 53,600 metric tons. Then in 2007, it essentially tripled. All right. Now, if you're a biologist and you look at this, basically, it doesn't make sense. You base that on their fisher characteristics that Paul had mentioned. Very slow growth rates, late maturing, reproduce very slowly. So how does a species that has all those characteristics triple their spawning stock biomass in essentially 3 years, 2 years? It doesn't make sense. Plus, if you look at all the females that were maturing, so that immature stock had essentially decreased since 1994 to 50%, very low. It doesn't make sense. It's not going to recruit in. So something strange is going on here with this species. Other things that caught our attention, you see catches like this by the commercial industry. That's a lot of fish. And when you're looking at a population at the time might have been at a low point, you think to yourself, how does this happen? You know, the recreational guys, same story. You go out and what do you catch? You catch dogfish. The line down is essentially a dogfish which you can bring up. So, about this migration and this movement, there's been some great work done by Dr. Lewison, who's going to present today about these migrations supposedly towards the north during the summertime, and they head up in the Gulf of Maine and hang out there. And then during the winter, they're supposed to move back down. So why was this large amount of dogfish being captured in this area, the Gulf of Maine, in December, in January? We're not supposed to be there, okay? So it's another anomaly. So these are just some of the questions that came to mind to us. Is that why are we seeing all these large abundance of this species at times where we're supposed to be there and based on areas where they might not have been there? So how do you study this? We were looking at using new technology. And one of the new forms of technology that's out there are these satellite tags. And it looks sort of like that. I'll go into a little more detail. But they've been used on all sorts of charismatic megafauna. You've got swordfish. You've got Greenland sharks. You've got great white sharks. You've got tuna. The species list goes on and on and on. And what these satellite tags do is essentially they record that animal's movement. It tracks their geolocation. It keeps track of their depth preferences. Keeps track of their temperature preferences. And sort of stores it and collect that information, and they can be transferred at a later date. We get a detailed profile of what that animal went up to. Another great aspect of this is that it is entirely fisher's independent. Once you put it on that fish, you don't need to recapture it. So you have if you have a static tag that is predetermined to pop off at a certain time. So if we want it to stay on for 6 months, we want it to stay on for a year. We can tell that tag to stay on for however long we want it to. Once it pops off, it transmits that stored data to satellite. And that satellite transmits to a land station, transmits it to us, and then we analyze that data. So again, we can get a detailed sort of track of that animal, where it's been, what it's been up to. The only downside to this is it's expensive, about $5,000 per tag. So better hope that you get your money's worth of them. But they can give you a lot of information. So the question became, can we use this technology on a smaller species such as fine dogfish? And that was our, kind of our whole goal. So we got development money to sort of look into this. And as you can see, this would be a normal size satellite tag. It's quite large. So we were pretty much out of luck. We tried sticking these on dogfish, it just didn't work. It ripped out of just about everywhere we placed it on that animal. Luckily, they developed a smaller tag, the X tag. And although it was smaller, it's not any cheaper, unfortunately. But it worked out perfect for our purposes. Now, the way you typically put these things on a large species is that you have a dart with a tip. And the tip, you can see, is about a little bit larger than the size of a pin. And then what you do is you jam that into the animal. And we tried to do that with the dogfish. And it didn't work too well. As you can see, they kept falling out. We tortured a lot of them. Some died. But we were trying to find that correct placement. I've got colleagues that are studying larger sharks, dusky sharks, silky sharks. And they're getting retention rates of 1 month or less just because they can't find that optimal position. So we didn't want to do that. So we had die-offs, and we found some alternative uses for them, and this could be something that we might be able to talk about later. This is a good one. It works pretty well. My favorite, actually, is this one. This is indeed my students with it. It's cold, so it kind of stings, but it works. So there's alternative uses here. I think we've got some good ideas. So, despite our failures, we did find a technique that seemed to work well for us in the lab. We got it just down for 3 months, and we thought that was good enough to test that out in the wild. So we went out. You have to catch the species. So we caught some, and we placed a tag on them, and then we released them. Now, I had enough money to buy three of these. They didn't want to give us hundreds of thousands of dollars in case it didn't work, so... The thing here to do is to show that we could do it. So, we release these fish, and then basically we pray to God that you get something back. You just don't want to kiss your $5,000 goodbye. So, luckily we got something back. And this is what it looks like. It's messy. It's ugly. And so what we need to do is we need to filter that information. And so we can mathematically do this as a common filter. And this basically is a model that anticipates the next step of that dogfish based on its previous step, its geolocations. We input such things as the symmetry, pieces of symmetry, to get a very precise movement pattern. And so what we can do is we can sort this up and we can get a pattern. What I'm going to show you is the movement pattern for one of our tagged dogfish. And so, the red line here is this movement in November, which is the starting point right here off the coast of Sockville, Maine. And you can see it made a beeline offshore, hung out there, made a quick trip up to Nova Scotia, went back down, and sort of curved around offshore, heading back up, headed towards New Jersey, just what you guys wanted to hear, and popped off over in January. We got about... close to 3 months of data for this dogfish. So this is our track from our second dogfish. Again, he's making a beeline offshore. kind of heading up towards North Scotia. Decided to hang around here for a little bit, moving more offshore in November. Then December, really starts to hang offshore here. And this is our distance here. This is about 400 kilometers. So you can see it's 700 kilometers offshore right now. Again, it's staying offshore, way offshore. Kind of moving around up here. So, again, really liking this area. And then it starts to make a beeline, you'll see, again, the coast of New Jersey, which I'm sure is not something you want to hear at this point right now. But again, you know, not that close. That's the thing. Pretty far offshore. They both basically popped up real close to one another. Now, these sharks were both tagged in November, essentially on the same day. It was on November 11th. So when you combine and kind of look at this, these tags together, you can see the pattern is fairly similar. You know, they head offshore, kind of hang out down there, and they make a beeline towards the coast of New Jersey. Still staying about 150 kilometers or so, up to, you know, 450 kilometers offshore before the tags popped off. But you can see very active moving pattern, constantly moving, both sort of north-south and east-west. I think what's interesting too, if we look at the depth profiles, here we have the date at liberty. The east number here represents a date that a sample was taken by a satellite tag. Here's the depth in meters. Okay, the black line designates nighttime movement from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. and these white lines are daytime movements from 6 a.m. or 6 from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. As you can see, highly active vertically, up and down, up and down, up and down that water column. There's no pattern. And there's no pattern with their movement as far as nocturnal or diurnal, no day-night pattern as well. So these fish are moving up and down that water column. They're not maintaining a steady depth at all. Tag number two, same thing. We've got the date at liberty. We've got our depth. One thing you'll notice here is the depth on this one is much deeper. The previous fish didn't go any deeper than about 50 meters. Here this one dropped down to almost 600. So, very deep. But again, no pattern.
Were they all females? Are they all females in the tag?
Yes, they were all females. Good question. These were all females. And so again, there's no diurnal pattern, no daytime, nighttime pattern. It doesn't matter if they're not staying on the bottom at a certain time period, not moving up towards the surface at a certain time period. So again, very active throughout the water column. So this is a half-filtered tag from our third individual. And you can see it's kind of sloppy. This has no sea surface temperature or bathymetry data in it. So it's cleaned up a little bit. But I'm going to show you guys anyhow. This one actually stayed on until May. So we got about 6 months worth of data on here. One of the things that's interesting here is that this movement, basically off the coast of Maine down to North Carolina, according to what that satellite tag is telling us, took place in 8 days. So they can move fast, north-south, very fast. You'll notice the points here on land, that can be a problem. Everyone saw what a land shark is. We had some spiny dogfish sighted, and that's one of those fish. I ate those kids. So you think you got problems offshore, you got them onshore as well. Not what you want to hear either, probably. So same thing with this individual. I'm still cleaning up this data, but you can see. No real pattern, up and down during day and night. This one dove down to about 200 meters. So if you look at this information sort of as a whole, this depth preference data, you see three very different profiles for those individuals. You've got one fish that's staying fairly shallow. You've got fish number three, which is somewhere intermediate in our depths. And you have fish number two, which is preferring deeper depths. So you've got a similar movement pattern, a southward sort of a movement that's maintaining a offshore distribution, but you're showing very different depth distribution patterns. And this could play a role in their catchability in NIMS surveys. So, speaking of NIMS surveys, this is a NIMS sort of biome, or their track line, or their bomb shelf areas. We got this from, I think, Joe Mello. We plot this in GIS. This gives you an idea of where they are. You've seen this before. Well, it's interesting, if you overlay this with our two filtered satellite tag data, you can see that sometimes they're in that, sometimes they're out of that track line. We want to take a closer look at this and what would this actually mean. If you look at fish number one, 90% of the time it was in that survey. So 90% of the time, just based on this information, you can say, well, it had a chance of being caught. One thing I will say, though, is that this is all sort of, the temporal time curve is not the same as the survey. This is, it followed that survey by a couple of months. But I think what we can say here is that some of these observations, there's some compelling sort of questions that we can ask. One of them was, well, if it was in the same area, okay, what would be the catchability if it were occurring at that cross survey time? So even though this specimen was in that survey 90% of that time, it had a 0% catchability at the depth. So even though it was in the area, it wouldn't have been caught. Tag number two spent about 35% of its time in that trawl survey. And the rest of the time was outside of it. If we compare the depth of those surveys to where that fish was, we see that it spent about 24% of its time at a catchable depth. So again, these are questions. What if that is actually the case? What if this population is only catchable at a certain proportion of its time in that survey? Yeah.
Yeah, when you're saying only 24% of the time at a catchable depth, are you saying, considering a catchable depth deeper than, say, 100 something fathoms?
Are you saying
when they fish are up in the water column, they're also not at a catchable depth?
Absolutely. I'm saying that they have to be at a catchable depth if they were at the depth of that trawl survey. So anytime they're not at that survey depth, whether it's offshore, whether it's same location, but up in the water column, they're not going to be caught. Okay? So 24% of the time, that fish could have been caught. Could have been in this area right here. Okay? The rest of the time, it's either out of that survey area, depth-wise, or just within the survey area, but much higher or much shallower. Okay? So what could this mean? If this were the case. If we look at Berea moving average, we've got 155,000 metric tons. You take our tag data and say that, well, maybe 25% are only being caught. That spawning stock biomass may actually be a lot higher. If you look at the total biomass on the 3-year moving average, and you compare that to what if only 25% of that could be caught, this might be a better representation of that biomass. So, anomalies, okay, lots of anomalies. This is the National Fisheries Service fault? No. Is it a behavioral problem with the dogfish? Absolutely. I mean, the behavior possibly could be precluding them from being captured by that survey. Other issues that may be stored up here. You know, this male-female ratio that the NIMS is showing, 4-1. Again, Dr. Wilson and Jones College is showing 11-1 and 1-11 and 1-9 ratio, you know, 1 male to 9 females. We're showing 1 male to 7 females in our data. We're showing a brownfish to dogfish ratio of 1 to 30. These are all anomalies that may be part of their behavioral patterns, you know, the preference for vertical movements. That might show up if we just use more of the satellite tags, look at more of the sort of movement patterns. So what does this kind of mean in a trophic perspective? And Dr. Kistler alluded to some of this in his talk. If you look at 3-year moving average, spawning stock biomass is 155,000 metric tons. If you look at that total biomass estimate, 478,000 metric tons, males and females, everything. Dogfish consume about 1.5% of the body weight per day. About 6 times that every year. they have to consume about 2.8 million metric tons of prey to support that biomass, just based on that NIMS data. So what are they eating? We've done some studies, and Dr. Pierce has also alluded to this. They eat fish. We found herring, yellowtail, snake worms, hake, sand lance, gadoids, haddock, things like that in their diet. Predominantly eating those things. And again, this might look familiar to you. What we're finding is that their diet consisted of gadoids, herring, right? That's that 93% right here. They love those things. So again, what's this mean for trucker perspective? If we use our satellite tag data estimates, 1.9 million metric tons based on the catchability factor. Doctors consume 1.5% of their body weight, 6 pounds of body weight per year. That metric, 11.5 metric tons has been needed to support that biomass. That's a lot of fish. Okay? So again, what are they preying upon? Juvenile cod, younger years, flounder. Okay, that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on there. Again, if their behavior is precluding them from being caught, this could be a whole lot of pressure put on that ecosystem. So where do we go from here? Again, our data is based on 3 tags right now. We've shown that it works. I think the next step is to see, you know, what we can really do with these things. We need to really quantify the sex-specific horizontal vertical movement patterns. What are the males and females doing together? Why are they separate? When do they come together? Is there a certain time of the year where a intro fishery might work more appropriately? I don't know. We really need to compare the horizontal vertical movement patterns of satellite tag dogfish to that bottom trawl survey. Okay, that's the most important thing here. We need to quantify that and see if there really is a catchability issue here, which I think that there is. You know, you've seen those vertical movement patterns, how quickly they can move up and down. North-south. And then again, we want to compare the movement of males and females in the Northwest Atlantic to really ascertain what's that little ratio, okay? Where is it all being? Is it because of this movement pattern? Are we just missing them because they're so active? And with that, I'll take some questions if you guys have any. Yep.
In your depth changes, is that related at all to river depth?
As you mean, its ability to move up and down water column, those differences that we're seeing. We haven't looked at that. At this point right now, it looks like some are they're all within the same general area of one another in the movement patterns. But some are just preferring different water depth. All the dogfish that were tagged were females of all about the same size. They're all mature. You know, we don't know why some are preferring a certain depth while others are preferring a different depth at different times of the month. Again, you know, they're all tagged about the same period, and they're all showing different preferences at those dates. So again,
you can't tell whether it's following food or
not at this point. No, that's some other things that we need to look at as well. Is to see what's the key here? Is it some sort of temperature? Is it food related? Is it reproductively related? Those are just all questions that we need to know. Right now, I think what we're showing is that they're highly active both vertically and horizontally. You know, they can move very fast north-south. They can move very fast up and down the water column. There's no pattern. You know, so you can't say, well, you know, they're nocturnally at the bottom and, you know, diurnally they're coming to the surface. You know, at this point right now, they could be anywhere in the water column at any time. Yeah.
Were you surprised by what you found?
Absolutely. Totally surprised. I mean, our whole hypothesis was that there was a separate Gulf of Maine population because we were seeing it almost year-round. We figured they were going maybe offshore during the coldest times of the year and then, you know, returning inshore. So when we saw this thing kind of make a beeline towards the east and then beeline basically south, it totally blew, you know, any of our hypotheses out of the water, basically. You know, we really thought that it was a separate stock. I mean, we did genetic work that has shown that it's not. I mean, this is one population from Maine all the way down to North Carolina. So there's something strange going on with their don't know, for lack of a better word, detachability. You know, we've got a large population out there that's just randomly moving.
The one fish that had right in Hudson Canyon in the Mid-Atlantic, what was the date of that?
Stuff right in here?
Okay,
right here, sorry. That's January. January, like 19th.
January 19th. And,
yeah.
and you tagged it on what day?
November 12th. November 12th.
So do you feel that NIMS's total for the adult fish is actually like a third of what it actually is? Is that really what you're looking at?
My interpretation is that the dogfish movement in their behavior, particularly vertically, is precluding them, or has the possibility of precluding them from being captured. So my assessment based on our limited satellite tag data would be obviously to say, well, we need more data. But it's compelling to say that it could be, if this were to hold true for the population, then it would be obviously underestimated because of its catchability. Yeah?
What further analysis or information can you do to determine whether or not their migrations are driven by food and other fish? That's the short little discussion I think that's going on
right
with Jim and Mari here. Because that fish headed right towards Hudson Canyon, underneath and in and around everything else that's going there.
If this one had been on longer, I bet you would have made it there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what we can do at this point is we can look at historical data and see, you know, where abundance of the fish have been tracked and that not. It would be really cool to sort of, in an ecosystem management context here, would be to, you know, track the movement of dogfish as it relates to migrations of other species. You know, the acoustic tracking of herons or something like that, to see how those two match up to one another. There's something that's definitely driving them. Some of it is probably temperature, obviously, but they have to go someplace to eat. And, you know, I don't know my geography of off the coast as well, but it sounds like this is a hot spot for the food.
Evident.
Yeah.
Yeah, my hypothesis here is to try to be a good change in terms of math.
Yeah.
And noise. Okay. And as they're following their own wonder seasonal migration to the south in the wintertime. My own experience in mud holes would be 40 miles inside of the Hudson Canyon there. Whiting fishing in the fall. We would have whiting in the, and this is in the deep part of the hole there, 200, 250 feet. We have whiting there, and then you would see a run of bluefish come in.
Mm-hmm.
Bluefish would come in, eat up the whiting, but they wouldn't eat them all up, and they'd leave. They would chase away by this wall of dogfish that would then move in. Okay, in January, December. When those dogfish moved in, the whiting disappeared, whatever ones were lucky enough to survive, and then the dogfish would move away about a month later, and there was nothing left in the mud hole, and nothing showed up until springtime. It was just void.
As far as time frame, is January, is that a time where it's a high productive year?
Yes, very.
Very productive. Well, that makes sense. It'd be interesting to see how that all sort of plays out. I mean, at least these two species specimens right here were off the bottom most of the time. You know, they weren't hugging, you know, in the water column.
I mean, we've seen dogfish on the top for miles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, they come right to the surface. Yeah, that's what makes them, like, you know, the whole opportunistic and voracious predator. They don't eat anything anywhere in that water column. I think that's interesting to note this right here about that, you know, sort of feeding area.
Do you have money to get more tags now?
We're working on it. We've got a couple of proposals in right now. So we'll see. What we really like to do is set tags out about a month before both surveys and to see, you know, how that overlaps and keep those tags on for as long as we possibly can, a year, and hopefully get overlap in the by both fish during the spring and fall surveys just to see, you know, if they're there, how long they're there, at what depths they're there. So, yeah, that's the goal right now. But like I said, they're 5,000 miles each. So it's a tough little swallow for some people. Yeah. Paul.
It's an interesting talk, and I agree that cashability is an issue, and I think that's what we see in a survey of these swings across years. It's higher said in the assessments, these are not biologically possible given the biology of this species, so they are associated with that. A lot of questions that I have, and I won't eat up a lot of time, but I wanted to ask one question. Have you
realized
the total distance on this track line?
Good, not that, no.
I mean, the one that was going fairly far, it was, in 8 days, it was doing about 600 miles?
It was moving fast.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Which is, have you seen whether that's biologically feasible in terms of
swimming speeds? No, that's an excellent question. And you're talking about this movement,
yeah,
basically,
right,
from here,
right,
down,
right,
to,
yeah,
here. One thing that you need to, with these satellite tags, is that they're great for ascertaining large scale movements. There is a error margin of probably about this much surrounding this point right here. Okay, so we know that it probably went from here, may have ended up here. Okay, but one of the best determining factors that we use is depth and temperature, and we can backtrack that, and we can compare that to the surrounding sort of environment, and use that to sort of find things, our geolocation data. So we've got a pretty good idea that it traversed at least to Delaware at this point right now. Did it make it all the way to North Carolina? We're still looking into that. All this data is... You would be amazed how long it takes to filter just one of these things. We've been working really closely with Molly Lekovich and the Large Pelagic Lab, who do all the bluefin tuna tagging. And it's amazing what goes into this deciphering what's going on here to make sure you've got the right track, kind of what's going on here. Biologically, you know, based on, you know, what we see in these movements, I think it wouldn't be unrealistic for them to end up down here, given the fact that what they've done, you know, in these tracks right here. It's all the stuff that we're finding is just totally much different than we expected. But that's a great point. Some of the next steps we need to do is to figure out, you know, distance per second that they can travel, you know, based on body length, movement patterns, you know, currents, you know, all those things. So right now, it's in the preliminary stage. We're very confident with these tracks. It's that third one, which we're working on. I mean, these have been filtered and refiltered and double-checked. So we're really confident that this is the movement. And, I mean, I had never even thought that what would be happening down here might be, I mean, they're ending up the same spot. It'd be, you know, take advantage of the traffic source right here. So.
Well, that explains why they're eating so much.
Yeah, it could be.
Like Hummingbird. When you have a long, straight line on there, that's connecting two dots where location was calculated. But there could be several days in between the two dots, and they're just connected because there's no location information in between them. So they likely didn't make a straight line.
So that's a minimum distance.
That's a minimum. Most likely, what we see, we have error bars around here. So they could have gone down, up, down, up, down, up, and down, up. They could have. It's quite possible. That's one of the, I guess, downfalls of the information is that sometimes you have missing, you have gaps, and then you just like figure out what's the best way to fill them. These tracks are pretty solid. For ease of, I guess, animation, we cut out some of the stuff, some of the points. But there wasn't a lot of gaps. The third one, there's a lot of gaps. And at this point right now, probably the best thing to do is just not fill those gaps in. It doesn't represent true movement. So we tagged it here, and it popped off. Our next point would be here, and so forth. So that's the problem at right now. Just to question the best way to represent the data.
When you say this tag pops off, it comes off the surface,
and then what it does is that it floats, it's buoyant, and so it transmits for about 30 days.
I mean, there's no possibility that tag just floated down.
No, that's a great question. What we do, and I can share you on this one, is that this is not where it popped off. This is 4 days prior to the pop off, and then so. Let me go back. I can show you. So here is a pop-off. And so this is drift.
Okay.
As it's transmitting. Okay? So they actually, when they pop off, they don't do anything for 4 days. They just sort of sit there and kind of hang out. It's a mechanism to avoid premature pop-off. They start transmitting their data and all that. And so we take 4 days behind that, and we discard all this floating information right here. So what we have is that the last data point that tag took before it popped. But yeah, it just floats and transmits. That's why if we can collect these things back, you get a better data representation. Because, salaries pass by like twice a day. If it's cloudy, it doesn't get the transmission. So that it just keeps going and going and going. Yeah? They are.
Okay. So, is it possible to take male fish because they're smaller than the females, and it looks like you had a hard time breaking off. Is a male fish, is it feasible to tag?
That's a good question. We actually tagged females that were just over that spawning stuff by my size. So all of the females, the average core length was like 82 centimeters. So they were small. They weren't the 90 plus centimeter females. That's a big male. Yeah, we're right now we've got research going on in the lab where we put different tag sizes and attachment types. What's that?
They might not like that.
I don't think they like it. Hey, I'm one of them. The size of the tag doesn't seem to limit them. We've got a new attachment site, this new way of attaching it that's reducing all the drag and everything that took place with the other ones. And I think that might have been a cause for some of them premature pop off of the other two. And we're going to stay on for a little over like 2.5 months. Which by all the standards, it was great, based on what my colleagues are finding.
Just one more observation. On that long first, like, 8-day swing here that you said, you let them go and they showed up, unaware. Or even south there. I think that's actually quite possible there. If the tag was acting as an easy pass, it would allow them to go through New Jersey without having to stop and pay a toll.
You see that? Well, I think that's what they did. They were going up in New Hampshire and down. They took that route, the easy pass route. But yeah, I know the information is definitely interesting. It does have its limitations, but I think the data you can get from it is pretty compelling as far as activity patterns and movements. And I had no idea that they were this active going up and down water column. Day night doesn't really matter.